Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. The life of Muhammad Ali this hour. He died last Friday at the age of 74 and was such an important figure in the last half of the last century. He's been described as the most charismatic and controversial sports figure of the 20th century. A prayer service for him is underway in Louisville, Kentucky today with an interfaith memorial tomorrow. They're expecting 14,000 people in Louisville today for the Muslim prayer service to honor Muhammad Ali. People are coming from all over the world. One of our guests this hour, who actually has written a biography of Muhammad Ali titled The Complete Muhammad Ali, Ishmael Reed, says Ali's career will make you cry. Long after he retired, he remained a symbol of rock-solid strength, but even during his career, he was in decline. Here was this young, self-described pretty boxer who could dazzle you with his raps, who was always bubbling over with confidence, but his 3 years away from the ring from 1967 to 1970 were damaging. The boxer Ron Lyle said that before Ali's absence, you couldn't touch him, but after he returned to the ring, it was easy enough. Ali was a boxer, but he was also a poet.
And the president lived in the White House. And Mary had a little lamb, his feet as white as snow, and snow white. And everything was white. Santa Claus was white. And everything bad was black. The little ugly duckling was a black duck. And the black cat was the bad luck. And if I threaten you, I'm going to blackmail you. So Mama wanted to call it white male. They lied, too. I was always curious. And then this is when I knew something was wrong. Won the Olympic gold medal in Rome, Italy. Olympic champion, the Russian standing right here, and the Pole right here. Is Poland considered a communist country?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm defeating America's so-called threats or enemies. And the flag is going, ton, 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 ton. I'm standing so proud. Ton, 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 ton. And I don't whip the world for America. Ton, ton, ton. I took my gold medal, thought I'd invented something. I said, man, I know I'm going to get my people freedom there. I'm the champion of the whole world, Olympic champion. I know I can eat downtown now. And I went downtown that day, had my big old medal on, and went in the restaurants. At that time, black things weren't integrated. The black folks couldn't eat downtown. And I went downtown, I sat down, and I said, you know, a cup of coffee, a hot dog. He said, the lady said, we don't serve Negroes. I'm so mad. I said, I don't eat them either. Just give me a cup of hot dog.
Muhammad Ali, an interview he gave on a British television show. We have two guests with us this hour, and we'll be welcoming your remembrances of Muhammad Ali. We have Ishmael Reed, a novelist, a poet, a playwright, and teacher. He taught creative writing courses at the English Department at University of California at Berkeley. He's a visiting scholar at California College of the Arts. He's held lecturing positions at many institutions, including Harvard, Yale, and Dartmouth. And he is the author of 30 books, most recently, The Complete Muhammad Ali. Ishmael has been the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant, has been a Pulitzer finalist, and has been nominated twice for the National Book Award. Ishmael, thank you very much for being with us this hour. I look forward to all that you have to say about Muhammad Ali. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Also joining us is Kevin Merida. Kevin joined ESPN in 2015, and he is editor-in-chief of The Undefeated. It's ESPN's media platform that explores the intersections of race, sports, and culture. He served as the Washington Post managing editor for news features and the Post Universal News Desk before that. And we thank you so much, Kevin, for being with us. Hello.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Happy to be here, Kevin.
Yeah, so it's amazing. They are attracting people. I've read this morning, Ishmael, 14,000 people in Louisville from all over the world to be at this Muslim prayer service. That's a lot of people.
Well, the Muhammad Ali machine was very good at publicity. And in my conversation with some of his friends in Louisville, they tell me that he was inspired by a wrestler. Maybe some of your listeners have heard of Gorgeous George.
Yes,
Gorgeous
George,
sure. Flamboyant wrestler,
mm-hmm.
Had a boastful attitude and played the heavy, and you know, really knew how to market the gate and you know, sweeten the gate and the revenue coming in. And I think Muhammad Ali was also successful at that.
Mm-hmm. When you say in the piece that was in the International New York Times, Ali's career will make you cry, how so?
Well, he was left broke and with brain damage.
Mm-hmm.
Was reduced to earning money by showing up in fights and being paid $1,000. And his after his fight with Larry Holmes, which was a devastating defeat, he was swindled by the boxing promoter, shortchanged, and his lawyer, who was suing the said boxing promoter, when he heard of this, he burst into tears. What Don King did was to send one of Ali's entourage to Ali and exhibited a stack of cash, because he knew that boxers, having not been trained in economics, would accept the cash instead of a check.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he was shortchanged.
Hmm.
His current wife, Lonnie, Yolanda Ali, found him mumbling and disoriented and sort of rescued him by going to Los Angeles when he was still married to Veronica Ali. And he sent her to business school, and she's the one who brought in millions of dollars so that he could live the rest of his life in comfort.
Oh, that's interesting. Kevin, let's talk about his place in history. He was, people tend to sugarcoat people, but when I look at Ali of the 60s and 70s, he was, somebody called him, as polarizing a superstar as the sports world has ever produced, because we had his religious beliefs that were under scrutiny, and certainly his political beliefs and his not wanting to go to Vietnam and what he said about the Viet Cong. He was, would you say, as polarizing a superstar as the sports world has ever produced?
Well, certainly. He was certainly polarizing. And, you know, he also was inspiring, you know.
Yes.
And in the sense that I think when we think about questions of black identity, we have a piece on our site now by Michael Fletcher that looks at him in the context of how he changed in some ways the whole nature of racial identity and how African Americans were seen. You know, I mean, he was not the first black athlete to carve out his own space, but he did so as Ishmael's noted and others. You know, he had rhymes, he had poetry, he had flamboyance, he had a way of calling attention to himself. He seized microphones, you know, and no one had seen anyone quite like that, to talk about you're the greatest at a time when, you know, African Americans were still fighting for really basic rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having dogs sicked on them and not able to have the vote in the place where he grew up, and this hurt him later as he reflected on it and thought about it. I mean, he grew up in Jim Crow segregation like a lot of people that era, and in Louisville, that's embracing him now, it was a place where the dominant sports figure was Adolph Rupp, who did not recruit African Americans to the Kentucky basketball team. And so he lived and grew up in an environment where blacks were often not regarded, not respected, and yet here he was, brash and confident, and brought a lot of swagger at a time before that was cool.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wasn't aware of the fact that his family traced some of their ancestry to Henry Clay, the Senator and Secretary of State, and his cousin, Cassius Clay, a noted abolitionist. Did Muhammad Ali talk about that? Did he tout that at all, Ishmael?
His mother's ancestor was a Abraham Brady, who came here broke and destitute, I think probably during the potato famine.
Mm.
And although Ali in the 1960s said that he had white blood, it was because a plantation owner raped an ancestor, when actually it was an Irishman who came here. And a few years ago, Muhammad Ali returned to Ireland. He met the Grady clan, members of the Grady clan, and 50,000 people showed up.
Oh, my gosh.
That wasn't covered in the American press. I read that in the Irish Times.
Huh.
So it's more complicated. His genealogy is more complicated than this story about Henry Clay. He's a complicated person. Now, Ali had a tendency to dismiss the boxers who came before him as Uncle Toms. For example, I have an anecdote in my book where Oscar Brown Jr. was in the company of Joe Louis, and they were watching Ali on television, and Ali called Joe Louis an Uncle Tom. He's quite an Uncle Tom. This is a man who fought two armed military police in a segregated bus station. Hmm. They approached him. He was in the bus station. One of them used a nightstick to jab him in the ribs, and before Joe Louis could respond, Sugar Ray Robinson had wrestled this MP to the ground.
Hmm.
And Joe Louis started punching out the other guy, and the fight ended when somebody said, "That's Joe Louis." That's Joe Louis. Joe Louis complained to the White House. Joe Louis was outspoken about civil rights and improved the condition of black servicemen in the segregated army. So he had a tendency, he had a mean streak when it came to black athletes, calling them Uncle Toms. He called Ernie Terrell an Uncle Tom. And he embarrassed Joe Frazier so much, called him an Uncle Tom. This is after Joe Frazier intervened and helped him out during his exile from boxing, that Joe Frazier's kids were harassed when they went to school.
Hmm.
So we have to remember that part of it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to remember the whole person. He started to box. I can't believe, you know, I'm not a big fan of boxing, I must say. It kind of, it gives me chills to watch people getting beat up, and I'm afraid they're going to die, and it's just, ew, I have a hard time with it. But he started to box, and there's some reason you must do this when you're 12 years old, Kevin, and continued for a number of years. Why did he start boxing at the age of 12?
Well, someone had stolen his bicycle, as a story that he had told, you know, many times. You know, boxing became, for a lot of young people, we had a big boxing program in my neighborhood in suburban D.C. It's Sugar Ray Leonard was in my same kind of cohort. And I remember watching Sugar Ray Leonard boxing our rec center when he was 14 years
really?
Old, and he went on to become a gold medalist. So I watched him box when he was 14 years old, boxing some of my friends. So there was a tradition in a lot of places, boxing programs developing, and kids finding boxing to be a way out of their neighborhoods. Also, you know, self-protection. You know, a lot of people turn to boxing because of protection. They wanted to not get beaten up. They wanted to be able to protect themselves. And this is before, you know, the days when people are pulling out guns quicker. People, you know, when I was growing up, people, they fought with their fists. And a lot of people went into boxing because of that. I wanted to say one thing, Kathleen, that it plays off of the very good point that Ishmael makes about the way Ali treated others. And also just to think now about how we treated Ali. And I think that there were a lot of people that were afraid and put their distance from
mm-hmm.
Ali. You know, Ali shares my birth date, and so I always looked at him with admiration as far back as I can remember, because he was somebody that I had never seen as an athlete, and he was somebody that inspired confidence. But there were a lot of people, you know, African Americans, they were embarrassed by him. You know, they were not comfortable with him. And it was also a time, his early association with the Nation of Islam, for some people that was bothersome. They didn't quite know how to get their hands on the Nation of Islam and that association, and they didn't like Ali. And so, I mean, today he's beloved and everybody embraces him, but it's worth noting that at the time it wasn't quite that universal embrace.
Yeah. What about you, Ishmael? Did you, when you were young, admire him?
I admired him because of his outspokenness, but you have to give the Nation of Islam a great deal of credit. I don't see that happening. I saw Henry Louis Gates' piece in the Times today. Not once did he mention the Nation of Islam.
Really?
Yeah, but Ali had a tendency to repeat verbatim things that he had read in Elijah Muhammad's Message to the Black Man. He was always recommending people to read that book. And Floyd Patterson, after he defeated him, urged that he read Message to the Black Man. So a lot of times what we hear from Muhammad Ali are speeches that were lifted from that book and from editorials in Muhammad's speech. Now, a lot of people give Malcolm X credit for recruiting Muhammad Ali into the Nation of Islam. Actually, it was a man named Abdul Rahman, Muhammad, Sam X. Muhammad Ali saw him selling newspapers on the street, Muhammad Speaks, and Sam X invited him into the organization. And that famous quote, "No Vietnamese ever called me," in words they say nowadays, that was created by Sam X. They were at home. The Muslim women were cooking for this gathering. And he wanted to know what to tell the reporters who were outside. And Sam X said, "Well, go on and tell them that no Vietnamese ever called you nigger." Now, you have to back up. His mentor, a father figure, Elijah Muhammad, actually went to jail. He went to jail for 5 years as a conscientious objector because he said he would refuse to fight the Asiatic black man. Mm-hmm. And actually went around the country making pro-Japanese speeches. They tried to get him for sedition. When they failed, they got him for draft dodging. He's 44 years old at the time, I believe.
Ooh.
So he was following the precedent of his mentor,
mm-hmm.
and that was the policy of the nation. So all this stuff about Muhammad Ali all of a sudden springing out from nowhere is just half the story. And I think that most of the other biographies on Muhammad Ali are only telling half the story.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in Julian Bond, a guy I've always admired, his comment about his joining the Nation of Islam. Bond says, "I remember when Ali joined the nation, the act of joining was not something many of us particularly liked, but the notion he'd do it, that he'd jump out there, join this group that was so despised by mainstream America, and be proud of it, sent a little thrill through you." I'd like for both of you to respond to that, starting with you, Kevin.
Well, certainly. Look, the Nation of Islam, it worked both ways. In some places, they were exotic, and no one knew what to make of them, and they were scary, particularly for people who grew up in the Christian faith. But in other communities, and I still remember selling fish in the trucks and coming by our neighborhood, the politeness, the fastidiousness,
mm-hmm.
and the sense of having some solidarity and in some places feeling protected to the Nation of Islam, particularly the Fruit of Islam being around. So I think it worked both ways. For a lot of people, the nation was a source of inspiration. Others, they were a source of threat and worry.
Mm-hmm. Ishmael, what do you think of Bond's statement?
Well, I think that the nation's contribution to boxing was that up until the nation, there were criminals who ran boxing. I think some of them have returned. But anyway, the Nation of Islam had a group called Main Bouts, which challenged the organized crime's control of boxing. They had a showdown in Toronto. I had my book published in Canada, so I had a passage about that. The mob's fighter was Ernie Terrell. Muhammad Ali and Herbert Muhammad were warned that if Ali didn't take a dive when he fought Terrell, he would end up in Lake Michigan.
Hmm.
These members of the Fruit of Islam paid the guy a visit who made the threat. And if you want to read the result of what that meeting, you can read my book. But that was not the first time that the nation challenged organized crime. Muhammad Ali's name came up in an FBI recording or taping of a meeting of members of the crime family. Hearing about this, the nation told members of the crime family that if anything happened to Muhammad Ali, they would come to New Jersey and kill everybody.
Whoa.
And they would go to the Waldorf Astoria and throw Frank Sinatra out of the window.
Whoa.
So, I mean, these guys are tough. There's another side of it. I mean, I have that in my book about the criminal elements in the nation, especially in Philadelphia. There was one mosque there that was that was really an organized crime unit. So that's that is part of the nation also. But when Wallace Muhammad took over from his father, he tried to clean those elements up, get rid of those elements. And Muhammad Ali followed him into Orthodox Islam.
Mm-hmm. We have you for just a few more minutes, so let me ask you this question about his place in sports history, Kevin, before we start taking phone calls and continue with Ishmael. Was he indeed the best heavyweight boxer ever, or was it his style, his flamboyance, his wonderful personality that gave him that description?
Well, I think we can argue that. It's like in every sport, you know, you can have the barbershop argument of was he the greatest heavyweight champion ever. He's certainly in the conversation for it, along with Joe Louis, others. But I think that for me, of course, I'd say yes. I think one thing, it's the combination of his personality, his persona, what his speed. He combined both speed and power as a fighter. And he fought everybody. You know, nowadays you see in boxing, in the recent period, where people are really strategic about who they fight. They duck people. Ali fought everybody of his time, you know, and there was no opponent that he ducked. I mean, even with the Frazier fight, I mean, he'd been off 3.5 years. And, you know, he had, like, you know, one warm-up fight to fight Frazier, the reigning champ. So, and then it was right back, and they had three epic fights. And so, whether it's Ken Norton, George Foreman, people thought he was going to get killed by George Foreman, literally.
Yes.
He fought everybody, Ernie Shavers, everybody who was a top contender. He took them all on. And I think that's something to be admired. And you recaptured a championship 3 times. So, in my mind, he is the greatest, as mm-hmm. he said he was.
And what about how we felt about him for not going to Vietnam? It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, I believe. But is the feeling now that we owe him a great deal of respect for having sacrificed 3 years at least of his young boxing career when he was at his prime and all kinds of money, millions of dollars, yeah, for his anti-war principles?
Well, that's the thing, Kathleen. I think that you know, we're not accustomed to athletes of the day of that stature sacrificing monetary, making a decision, however you make the decision, and risking losing millions of dollars at the prime of their earning power. Mm-hmm. That's just something that doesn't happen. Usually, you know, nowadays the modern athlete's surrounded by, you know, not only agents and publicists, and, you know, they have shoe deals and,
right,
and other endorsements. And all of these people, they have some influence often on the athlete's decision-making. And so I think that was a pretty notable achievement.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, thank you for being with us. I hope you'll join
us
again.
Kathleen.
Thanks. Kevin Merida with us, the first part of the show. He is with ESPN, and he is editor-in-chief of The Undefeated, which is their media platform exposing the intersections of race, sports, and culture. Ishmael Reed stays with us. He is the author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. Ishmael is a novelist, poet, playwright, and teacher, and will continue and start taking your phone calls as well. Here's how you reach this conversation about Muhammad Ali, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, we love to read your comments there, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We continue now and start taking phone calls. Today there is a Muslim prayer service for Muhammad Ali in Louisville, Kentucky, where thousands of people have been attending, and tomorrow an interfaith prayer service. We're talking about his life this hour, his very complicated and very large life, with Ishmael Reed now, and starting our phone calls with Randy in Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon, Mr. Reed. One of the earliest interviews Alex Haley ever did for Playboy magazine was with Muhammad Ali, about 7 months after the Sonny Liston fight, and it got surprisingly a little attention because it was a real eye-opener for me, since Ali revealed that a lot of his boastfulness and, you know, sort of the mouth from the South persona was a tactic. It was designed to make Liston not take him seriously. And in fact, Liston, if I recall right, did not train much past the first four rounds, so that Ali was able to outlast him. And oddly enough, even though he laid it out on paper then, 10 years later, he was doing the same thing with the George Foreman fight. Foreman did not train far enough to last all 15 rounds, and it worked once again. I just wanted to get Mr. Reed's take on that.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. Ishmael?
Yes. Sonny Liston, who was called by Joe Louis the greatest heavyweight champion of all time, during the first fight was suffering from a shoulder injury and tried to have the fight postponed, which is common practice nowadays. The Miami Boxing Commission refused. And so when he retired on the stool, it was because of a bursitis or shoulder injury. And a medical team verified that he was injured. So you might consider that to be sort of like a lucky break there in that fight. In the second fight, Ali threw a legitimate punch called the Phantom Punch. While that fight was purported to be fixed, or said to be fixed and was investigated, three former champions, including Rocky Marciano, Jose Torres, I think he was maybe not the champion then, and Jim Braddock, the Cinderella Man, all agreed that it was a legitimate punch. Now, I saw Muhammad Ali fight in Madison Square Garden in 1963 against a contender named Doug Jones. It's a consensus among the, you know, the people who watched the fight and Jack Newfield, the late Jack Newfield, whom I interviewed, that Doug Jones won that fight. We were so much in awe of Muhammad Ali, we thought he'd just be floating like a butterfly, like a bee. Doug Jones staggered him a couple times. And Doug Jones never recovered from that, not getting that decision. Then he was put in line to fight Sonny Liston. On the other hand, Sonny Liston had to fight everybody on the way up and everybody on the way down. There were all kind of different criminals who owned pieces of him, and Floyd Patterson's manager refused to even give him a heavyweight championship fight. So some of this was luck, and some of this was charisma. And another point I wanted to make is that he was never as harsh on his white opponents as he was on the black opponents.
Hmm.
I mean, calling, you know, Joe Frazier a gorilla.
Right.
And the fight in the Philippines, even bringing a toy monkey or something in the ring and all that. No white fighter would have ever gotten away with that. So I think there are different aspects of Ali. For example, the Playboy, I'm glad that the gentleman brought that Playboy interview. In that Playboy interview, he said that interracial couples ought to be murdered.
Mm-hmm. And did that come? Did that come from Elijah Muhammad?
Well, I have no idea. I think that Elijah Muhammad was a pragmatist who had white people at his dinner table. I was shocked to hear that.
Hmm.
All during this period about the white man is the devil, he had a number of white people at his dinner table. And Cup, I think there was a man named Cup, who was a broadcaster in Chicago.
Irv Cupp's in it. Yeah, I remember him.
That's right. That's his name. He's a close friend of Elijah Muhammad's. And he also had a friend named Gene Kilroy. Gene Kilroy still praises him. He's a white man. He said that Elijah Muhammad was a great man. Now, listen to the irony of this. A couple of years ago, Muhammad Ali attended the bar mitzvah of his grandson.
Hmm. Interesting. So where did these racial epithets toward fellow black boxers come from? What was that all about with Ali?
Well, some believe that, Ali was more inclined to favor, at that point, European aesthetics than black aesthetics. He called African women ugly.
Hmm.
And he said that he was glad that after visiting Africa, that he was glad that his grandfather caught the boat, his great-grandfather caught the boat. And at one point, he said that he was going to, when he got it, arrived in Zaire, he was going to take all the sports writers he didn't like and put them in a cauldron and boil them. The Mobutu government had to answer and say, we do not eat people over here.
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe that was humorous. Maybe that was considered funny. But there are many sides. And I think the Ali who followed Wallace became a universalist, a humanist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the period that we should all pay attention to. Now, we can maybe even forget about the fact that he endorsed Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like became more conservative and refused to make it a stand on the Iraq War, which is something that Thomas Hauser criticized him about. Thomas Hauser was the official biographer
mm-hmm.
of and who's given the blessings of Yolanda Ali to write the official biography. But I think he became what's really another irony is that he turned his back on Malcolm X, and when he saw Malcolm X in Africa, he ridiculed him as some kind of holy man. Muhammad Ali ended up being a very generous,
yes,
holy man.
Yes. The New York Times article about him said that people would just call his home and ask for things, and he would almost always say, sure, yes.
That was my article. That was my piece.
That's your article, right. He was a really generous man.
I interviewed Howard Moore, Jr., the attorney who got Angela Davis off, who was a frequent visitor to Muhammad Ali's home in Los Angeles. And he said people call all day asking for the request, and he just give money away.
Hmm.
Emil Guillermo, the Filipino-American journalist, said that he gave some man $25,000 when he was in Manila. And Ed Hughes, his oldest friend, told me that a destitute family, Filipino family, destitute, came up asking for money. Ali brought him up to his suite, and he didn't have any money, but he had people in his entourage give him some money. So the guy had a big heart, but he was exploited. He was
mm-hmm.
exploited. Kevin mentioned that Ernie Shaver's fight. He was so damaged in that fight that Teddy Brenner, who arranged fights at Madison Square Garden, said he'd never book him again.
Oh.
1966, he fought George Chavallo, and he was urinating blood.
Oh.
Later, he was urinating blood after a fight, and Ferdy Pacheco, the fight doctor, said you got to stop his career. He's taking too much damage to his body. And he sent letters to all of Ali's intimates, and nobody replied. And in his last fight, Angelo Dundee had to interrupt that fight with Larry Holmes because nobody cared. And his last fight with Vervick, the last fight he fought, he was in no condition to fight. So it's a sad story. I mean, there's a lot of glory there, but there's a lot of tragedy and sadness.
Yes. Let's go to more phone calls for you. Jim is next in Hillsborough. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Mr. Reed. Great show. I'd like to ask about the legality of the boxing commissions of the day and the state governments denying Muhammad Ali a license to box, his right to make a living, during the time that his appeals were pending as far as the draft evasion case. Was that legal for them to do?
I don't think so. I think it was a result of mass hysteria, just as his being requested or drafted was a case of mass hysteria, because he failed the test at first. And there was such a movement and an outcry that here this guy beats up people in the ring, and their sons had to go to Vietnam, and why shouldn't he go to Vietnam? So I think there was unfairness all the way around. And finally, you know, the Supreme Court overthrew the conviction. One of the reasons is because Stuart Potter had read Elijah Muhammad's message to the black man.
Oh, really?
Which I wonder why it's not a bestseller.
Anything else, Jim?
No, I understand that the Supreme Court vote initially was 5-3 to uphold the conviction, and then after one of the justices read the book, then they were deadlocked and they decided to be unanimous. Thurgood Marshall had recused himself, so it was an 8-0 unanimous decision.
Stuart Potter's clerks introduced the book to him.
Hmm. Well, that's a great story. Is that true, then? that it was 5-3, and then the book was read. And it
the caller's correct.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number. I want to talk a bit about what I've read about his bio, that he, the only subjects in which he got good grades, he was in segregated schools in Louisville, were art and gym. He graduated 376th in a class of 391, was never taught to read properly, and never read a book, and he memorized all of the poems and all of the speeches. Is that true?
That's possibly true, but I think that his university was the Nation of Islam.
Ah.
Elijah Muhammad was I think he might have only had 3 years of education, but he read 100 books in the Library of Congress, so he was really a scholar, mm-hmm. like a sort of like off-campus scholar. And I think there was a lot of tutoring that happened when Muhammad Ali was with the so-called messenger. And sometimes there were gaps in his education that were clear. For example, he was treated so well in England, they love him in England, that he said, these are possibly people who never fought a war.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I guess he had a few gaps.
Yeah.
And what about the sport of boxing? When you saw Muhammad Ali, doesn't it make you cringe to watch people boxing each other, Ishmael?
If there's any good that will come out of Muhammad Ali's career, it's that something that Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, Teddy Atlas, and others have been urging. Senator McCain, a boxing union. There should be a union for boxers, just as there is one for football players and basketball players. Right now, boxing is run by promoters who are destroying the sport. Matter of fact, I'm finding UFC more interesting. Sorry. I mean, I've been a boxing fan all my life.
Mm-hmm.
But there's such corruption going on now,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, telegenic stars and people who make money for television are put in against people who have absolutely no chance of winning. And some don't even haven't been trained. So it's become like a big racket because it's controlled by Top Rank and Golden Boy and Don King and others. We should eliminate promoters and have this have boxing regulated.
And was the boxing, all the beating that he took, horrendous beating, did it directly result in Parkinson's, do you think?
Well, you know, some people say it's pugilistic or dementia, that it's not Parkinson's. It's taking all those... My brother's a doctor, Dr. Michael Knorr, who lives here in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's not Parkinson's disease. He says, you know, he was hit 29,000 times.
Ooh, brother.
Now, if... if there's greatness, it's greatness before 1967. But after he returned to boxing, he got hit a lot. He slowed down. I mean, you know, able to touch him. He took even when he won a fight. This is why Rocky Marciano quit. Even though he won those fights, he took such a beating from people like Jersey Joe Walcott, Archie Moore as a child. He quit. I mean, he got tired of having his jaw broken and all this.
Right, yeah.
Getting all busted up.
Right.
So even though Ali won some of those fights, and there's a dispute as to whether he won the fights against Norton. As a matter of fact, I think it was George Foreman said Norton won all those fights. So at a point he got gift. He's so great at drawing crowds and money that he began to get gift decisions.
Let's go to Mary next in Bangor. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I've got some comments to make about Muhammad Ali's lighting of the Olympic flame at the 84 Olympics.
Yes.
Our society likes to diminish the manhood of African-American men. I was just so impressed with how manly and dignified Muhammad Ali seemed, even though his hands were shaking as he lit the Olympic flame.
Yeah.
I'll yield to the author there.
Yeah, there was a moment that could make you cry, wasn't it, Ishmael?
Well, you know, I interviewed, my book includes points of view from a number of black people, including black novelists and poets and black nationalists, and there seems to be an agreement among them that the mainstream loves him now because he's been shut down. That, you know, he was reduced to this pitiful state. So, somebody who, you know, made these harsh comments about American society. As I say in my article, the Louisville lip had been stitched. Now,
mm-hmm.
that's their point of view. It might be a cynical point of view, but those are the opinions of people I interview.
Mm-hmm. But he did it. Why did he do it? Why did he come to that ceremony in Life of Flame?
Michael Ezra, in his book, says that it was a marketing ploy that was arranged by his wife, Yolanda.
Uh-huh.
Now, that brought in a lot of money. That put him in a position for Yolanda to sell his name. You know, his name was sold for $50 million.
Was it?
Yeah, and so if you listen carefully, you hear his name and his voice on some commercials. For example, during the Super Bowl, there was an ad with Ali's voice in the background. And then, what's that luggage? Baton luggage? There was a big baton luggage campaign where they used his likeness. So his likeness, 80% of his likeness was sold to the same group that owns the likeness of Elvis Presley.
Hmm. Interesting. Mary, thanks very much for your call. Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. In the early 70s, I was in a department store in Madrid, Spain, with a friend wandering around. And here in the middle of the store was this big cluster of people. So, of course, we went over to see what was going on. And in the middle of this group of people was the most beautiful human being I've ever seen in my life. Everything that you can say about Muhammad Ali is true, but this man was so gorgeous. He turned around and he looked at us, and the expression, can't breathe, where you lose your breath, I don't think I breathed for like a minute. He had a glow about him, and you could just, the love that people had for him was kind of radiating out into this group of people. He was a beautiful, handsome man, and I will never forget seeing him.
No, I guess you won't. You describe it so vividly so many years later. He was a beautiful man, wasn't he, Ishmael?
He was very charismatic. I covered the fight in 1978 in New Orleans between Ali and Leon Spinks, who's actually cleaning toilets right now.
Oh, my gosh, really?
For a living, yeah. Thank you. But anyway, I opened the door, and Ali was standing before me. And he was with his wife. It was like a god and his queen, you know. Just I found myself the greatest man in the world. I just spontaneously, you know. But yeah, we're all in awe of Muhammad Ali.
Thanks so much, Marty, for your call. Dan is next in Green Bay. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and Muhammad Ali was actually a neighbor of ours. Same block anyway. And when I took boxing lessons from the Camden County Police Athletic League, and our instructor was Jersey Joe Walcott, so little experience with him. I do have a question, though. When I was growing up, Ali was very much against interracial dating and interracial marriage, and I wonder if he mellowed with age or if he kept that opinion throughout his life.
Well, I read Jim Brown, the football player's Bound to Glory, and Jim Brown questioned him about that because at the time when he was saying that, Ali had an Italian girlfriend. And Muhammad Ali's reply was that Italians are not white.
Oh.
So that's another contradiction. But Chilberg listed a number of contradictions of Ali's that you can read in my book. Now, you talked about, was it Cherry Hill, New Jersey? He was his host was the Major Coxon, was called the King of East Coast Heroin. So, what's his name? Joe Frazier pointed out that he's living very well during those years because the mansion was lent to him and his wife by Major Coxon. Major Coxon was murdered in a mob hit, and when that happened, Ali said he didn't know the guy all that well.
Hmm. Thanks, Dan, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the life of Muhammad Ali on this day, where in Louisville, some 14,000 people have been participating. I imagine it's over now, in a Muslim prayer service honoring his life. And tomorrow there will be an interfaith prayer service. People have come from all over the world. We're welcoming phone calls. Our guest has written a biography. He's written a lot of other books, but pertinent to our conversation, Ishmael Reed's book about Ali is The Complete Muhammad Ali. Ishmael is a novelist, poet, playwright, and teacher. Taught creative writing at UC Berkeley and is currently visiting scholar at California College of the Arts. He has lectured at Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth, many other places. Welcoming phone calls, as you remember the life of Muhammad Ali. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I want to talk to Ishmael about the relationship between Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali. Cosell, I think, got Ali and put him on television frequently and kept him in front of the TV cameras, but the two of them are fun to watch when you look at old clips. So before we return to the conversation, just a little bit, a little collage of Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell.
I done made you famous enough. Everywhere I go, you follow me to get your name in the papers and on television.
You'd still be stealing bikes in Louisville if
it wasn't. Don't tell people I stole bikes.
You always said, Muhammad, you're not the man you were 10 years ago, right?
Right.
Well, I'm going to ask your wife, are you the man you was last year?
You'll get a quick answer to that.
We're welcoming phone calls for Ishmael. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I was watching some old clips of Ali and Howard Cosell this morning, Ishmael, and it's really quite fun to watch those clips. There was something charming between the two of them.
Yeah, well, Gene Kilroy, who was Muhammad Ali's manager, and he's the one who said that he should stop running different training camps and settle on one. This is the reason that Ali bought Deer Lake. He says that they weren't all that close. He says that...
Really?
Yeah, he says that Cosell was never a guest in their home, and that at one point when Cosell began to embrace Sugar Ray Leonard as the new Muhammad Ali, he put down Muhammad Ali. So I think it's a mixed story, but yeah, they do some entertaining routines, but I don't think they were close friends.
Oh, that's interesting to know. And what about the people who stopped? I can't remember which fight this was, when the Beatles showed up and Frank Sinatra showed up at another fight. He really attracted some pretty big-name celebrities who wanted to be photographed with him, didn't he?
Well, Frank Sinatra was disappointed with Floyd Patterson when he was defeated by Muhammad Ali. As a matter of fact, Floyd Patterson, I think, visited Frank Sinatra the next day, asked for his forgiveness, I guess, I don't know, and Sinatra refused to talk to him. But then when later on, Frank Sinatra proposed tributes to him, and I think they did a children's record about dental health together.
Hmm.
So they had a mixed relationship. Now, Sugar Ray Robinson, get them mixed up. Sugar Ray Robinson's son told me that Frank Sinatra was sometimes behaved on the, or acted as a representative of the mob to try to get people to, you know, cooperate with the mob in fights. And he actually paid a visit to Sugar Ray Robinson's camp to ask him, told him that there's some people he wanted Sugar Ray Robinson to talk to, and Robinson had him thrown out of the camp. So they left Sugar Ray Robinson alone because they thought he was crazy.
Hmm. So, how do we...
I hate to be leveling all these icons.
All right. I mean, I think we have to get a complete picture of who somebody was. And when I'm always interested in somebody's early life, when I think about ending the interview where we started it, Muhammad Ali doing this wonderful thing at the Rome Olympics and then coming back and not being able to get a hot dog at a restaurant.
Well, he said that he was so disgusted that he threw his medal in the river.
Right.
Now, some people have disputed that. Some of the biographers have disputed that. But in his the book that he did with his daughter, he made that claim again.
Hmm. So it may be true?
Maybe true.
Maybe true. Ishmael, I want to read your book about him. Thank you ever so much for being with us on this day.
Well, Kathleen, thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Ishmael Reed, a novelist, a poet, a playwright, and teacher. He is the author of a number of books, most recently, The Complete Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, of course, died last week at the age of 74, the greatest, as he called himself, and what a What a fascinating person on so many levels, political level and sports level in this country. There's a prayer service that has been going on this morning, a Muslim prayer for service in Louisville, people from all over the world, and an interfaith prayer service tomorrow. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing such an interesting program. Indeed it was. He found great guests for this hour conversation. And thanks also to Scotty and to Carrie Salinas for doing on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're going to have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio. All of you have pets. An interesting and rather challenging hour next hour when we talk about, is it ethical to have pets in our homes? We'll talk about that next.